We're talking about saving trees from invasive pests here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Science and environmental journalist Gabriel Popkin draws stark comparisons between the widespread destruction of our forests and the COVID pandemic. And that's because trees are dying from invasive species and diseases that spread as people travel and they transport things around the globe. Popkin recently wrote about this in the New York Times, and he talked with WPR host Keely Boltina about what he's seeing.
The ways plagues make trees sick and make people sick are different. Can you help us understand how that works, why they're different?
It's a great question. Obviously, humans and trees are very different. We breathe in oxygen. We have lungs. So that seems to be how COVID-19, which is, I know, on everybody's mind, that's how it gets to us. Trees are different, but they definitely still have plagues. And these plagues can be caused by a variety of different kinds of organisms, anything from fungi to insects to even these things called water molds.
And yet, you're clear that you see parallels between the insects and the diseases that spread among trees and the contagious diseases that we deal with as human beings. So how are they similar?
Both humans and trees, we sort of live in an environment with a lot of different things that are always trying to attack us. Like there are all these cold viruses and flu viruses floating around. Sometimes we get sick, but you know, our immune systems are pretty good at handling those things. Similarly, trees have to deal with all kinds of things, fungi, bacteria, insects trying to eat them, attack them. And trees have an immune system. It doesn't exactly work like ours. Trees can produce hundreds of different chemical compounds that help them defend themselves against disease and insects. And that's why, you know, you might have a tree that gets attacked. Sometimes you'll even see trees get defoliated, but they just come back the next year because they can handle the usual sorts of organisms in their environment. But when either humans or trees, encounter an organism that's very different from anything we've ever seen, that's when real problems can occur. Trees, let's say trees that are live in North America, they have not seen insects or pathogens that might live in Europe or Asia because these continents have been separated for millions of years. And trees in that time have evolutionarily diverged. And each species has its sort of own set of organisms that attack it or feed on it. So when one of these organisms is transported to a new continent, it finds all these trees that have had no opportunity to evolve defenses. This didn't really happen very much before 1492 because fungi, insects can't really cross oceans on their own very often. But once humans started crossing oceans, they took organisms with them. And this includes both kind of accidental introductions and also intentional introductions. As soon as that started happening, that's when trees on different continents started meeting new diseases and new insects that often they had absolutely no defenses against. Columbus himself did intentionally bring livestock and I think certain plants from Europe to the New World, or what they call the New World. But as far as I'm aware, the first major tree plague outbreak occurred in the early 1900s, which was chestnut blight. So even though species were being transported across oceans for a long time, the sort of level of global trade that we see today is a more recent phenomenon where you really just have huge numbers of ships transporting things from continent to continent, you know, including people intentionally import plants. Like they say, hey, Japan has some nice hemlock trees, or, Europe has this different kind of chestnut tree. Like, let's bring it over here so we can put it in our gardens. And that's plant trade is what, you know, started the introduction of these forest pests. Mm-hmm.
We're learning from Gabriel Popkin. He's a journalist who focuses on science and society, and we're talking about threats to America's forest. This is the Ideas Network. And Gabriel, you brought up hemlocks. In the early 1950s, scientists found this insect from Japan that threatened American hemlock trees. What happened?
From what I've read, this insect was first discovered in a botanical garden in the Richmond, Virginia area in the early 1950s. But people think it actually was there probably for several decades before that. And these botanical gardens, you know, sort of owned by wealthy people, these folks really wanted plants from all around the world. This was a really popular thing to do in the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, was to go around the world and collect plants, bring them to the U.S., grow them. It was sort of a status symbol. I think it was part of, you could say, part of American imperialism as well. And nobody thought about the consequences. So with hemlocks, these hemlocks were imported, I believe, from Japan. They grew probably in a benign seeming way. And then this insect was discovered, but nobody knew what it was. Even after it was discovered, nobody really took action until sometime around in the 1970s, maybe 80s, when suddenly people started seeing hemlocks dying. So that's when the alarms were sounded. But by that time, this insect is all over the landscape. It spreads by, you know, birds can spread it, wind can spread it. There's just, at that point, there was no stopping it. It was way too far gone for anyone to put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak.
Is this a problem in Wisconsin?
Not yet. The last I heard, the hemlock woolly adelgid had not been detected in Wisconsin. Now, it certainly could be a problem because Wisconsin has a lot of hemlock trees. Hemlock loves cool, shady, moist areas, and northern Wisconsin in particular has a lot of those. If you go up to the North Woods, there's hemlock everywhere. The Menominee Reservation in northern Wisconsin, the Menominee tribe are globally recognized for their forest management. And one thing they do is that they really keep hemlock on the landscape. So there's a lot of reasons to be worried about the hemlock woolly adelgid. The good news for Wisconsin is that Wisconsin has cold winters, and it seems that the adelgid can't really survive below about negative 40. So as long as winters keep getting down to that temperature, that should really keep the adelgid at bay. But climate change is warming up winters very rapidly, and the warmer winters get, the less protection there is against hemlock woolly adelgid. And the other thing I would note is that the adelgid has recently been detected in Michigan, right across Lake Michigan. So it's, you know, not hard to imagine the adelgid hopping over the lake somehow or another and landing in Wisconsin.
And you just mentioned the issue of climate. Invasive species and diseases, when they kill trees, they actually contribute to our warming climate, right?
That's correct. The hemlock woolly adelgid is absolutely deadly. The hemlock species we have in the eastern U.S. really have no defenses against the adelgid. And so as soon as those trees are dead, they start decomposing. And when trees decompose, a large fraction of the carbon that is stored in bark, in wood, in roots, and so on, will end up in the atmosphere. Now, I think it's important to note that this doesn't happen overnight. I often go hiking in Shenandoah National Park, and I see, you know, large hemlock stumps, or I mean, whole trees even, that have probably been dead for 30 years and are still standing or lying on the ground or lying across streams. So it's not like a forest fire where all that carbon goes up in a day. It's going to be a long process, but ultimately a lot of that carbon will end up in the atmosphere.
That is Gabriel Popkin talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. They continue this conversation about invasive insects and diseases ravaging our forests. That's ahead here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. From hemlocks in ash, chestnut trees, elm trees, contagious diseases are decimating our nation's forests. Science journalist Gabriel Popkin says we should reconsider how we travel, how we ship and import plants if we expect to keep forests safe and healthy. We pick up the conversation as he talked with WPR's Keely Baltina earlier this year.
My family tries to get out and walk around, and I kid you not, in 2 days, I have had 3 socially distanced conversations with people out in their yards about all of the ash trees that we've had to take down because of the emerald ash borer. I mean, people see this in their communities as well as forests. Is it fair to say that this threat is real for everybody, even if you're living in a fourth-floor apartment in the middle of a city, that we should be worried about these things?
Oh, absolutely. Ash is one of those trees that has been planted throughout American cities because it's a great tree. It's beautiful. Some ash species grow very quickly, provides really nice shade. And I guess probably people like it because it doesn't drop huge nuts or acorns or anything like that. In fact, I lived in Wisconsin about a decade ago, and in the backyard of the house where I lived was a beautiful old white ash tree that provided amazing shade and amazing fall color. You know, I would be afraid to revisit that tree because I imagine it's probably gone by now. Yeah, the emerald ash borer has cost cities billions and billions of dollars in tree removal costs. Ash trees are also very important ecologically. And one thing about ash is that there are many species of it in North America, and they each sort of specialize in different environments. Green ash is a real wetland tree. It loves to be near water, and it grows a lot in streams and wetlands. And so when those trees die, those streams and rivers, wetlands, are much less protected from nutrients coming in, say, from nearby farm fields. And it really can change the entire ecosystem. That's also true for black ash, which grows kind of farther north, like in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. On the other hand, white ash is more of an upland tree, and you might find that in the mountains and as an important part of those forests. And as you mentioned, in cities, both green and white ash have been planted a lot. And yeah, that's definitely going to take cities a while to recover from the emerald ash borer.
We planted a lot of them. Are these ash trees that are under attack native to Wisconsin, or is this an example of that tree trade that you talked about that went wrong?
No, they're native trees. We have, I believe, 16 native species of ash tree in the United States, and all 16 are believed to be vulnerable to the emerald ash borer.
And there's an additional cultural aspect to this when it comes to tribes in Wisconsin.
That's right. Tribes in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest own pretty sizable chunks of forest, and these forests often have ash trees. And there's a traditional use of ash trees for really making a lot of different kinds of crafts, but the one that I think people that is best known is basket making. The black ash has these, the bark sort of comes in strips, and it's quite easy to separate the strips from one another. I actually saw this done a couple of years ago. And you can, in a day, you can cut down a tree, separate the bark into strips, and have a basket. And this was a very important kind of traditional use of ash. It almost died out from the Midwest, but it's actually being revived. There's some great basket makers, one in particular who I met on the Bad River Reservation in northern Wisconsin. And she tells me that so far she hasn't seen the ash borer where she lives, but she's very worried about it. And in fact, is already sort of making plans to figure out how to keep her basket making business. I mean, it's a real money making business going after emerald ash borer comes through.
Gabriel Popkin wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times arguing that the United States is not prepared for diseases and invasive insects poised to decimate our forests. You're listening to the Ideas Network. And even beyond basket making, I mean, this isn't just an ethical conundrum or an environmental conversation. Invasive species and diseases, they threaten people's livelihoods, their money.
That's right. There was a recent study that came out that put the cost of all invasive species globally at over $1 trillion. Now, this is over several decades, but anytime you're talking about $1 trillion, that's, you know, that's big money. These things are definitely taking a chunk out of the global economy. There's no question about that.
We've talked about the fact that transporting plants can be a problem because it spreads invasive species, but they can also like hitch a ride on packing material and get from overseas to here and then attack?
Exactly. And that's actually what happened with the emerald ash borer. It's thought to have come in on wood pallets. You know, I'm sure everyone's seen goods shipped on wood pallets. This is a very common way to pack goods onto these large container ships. The emerald ash borer first showed up in the Detroit suburbs. Detroit obviously has a port, and the thinking is that it just hitched a ride on some wood packing material. Nobody even thought about this potential problem. And then by the time the ash borer was discovered, it was already way too late. It was widespread in the environment. some of the earlier plagues came, like chestnut blight and hemlock woolly adelgid, came in on live plants. And so the USDA recognized that and really ratcheted down on the kinds of plants that could be imported. And I think it's been a while since a major new plague was imported on live plants, not to say it couldn't still happen. But it turns out when you sort of close one pathway, then often another pathway opens up. And so this pathway for insects to come in on wood that hasn't been properly treated has been a big one. Here in the East Coast, there's also this new thing, the spotted lanternfly. People think that came in on landscaping stone. So some landscaping company imported some stone from another country, and just, you know, this weird insect that nobody had ever thought about just hitched a ride. So that's a kind of a newer area of concern. And, you know, it's not the only one.
This is where you draw another parallel between trees and people in this pandemic, because we knew that something could come. Experts have shouted that the world was not ready for a pandemic, even though it was a real possibility. You say that translates to the situation with our woodlands.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a group of environmentalists, advocates who've been for quite a while sort of calling on the government to do more to prevent the introduction of these forest pests. And obviously they're competing with a lot of people who want the government to do more of a lot of different things. But, you know, I think they have kind of a strong argument that every day thousands, if not millions, of containers enter the U.S. Carrying all kinds of goods, and only a small fraction of these are inspected. Now, I do think it's important to give credit. Government agencies have gotten a lot smarter about how they do this. They sort of have this risk rubric where they can kind of make decisions about which containers to inspect. And they've gotten stricter when they do find a forest pest, let's say on an improperly treated wood pallet, they punish the company. So that didn't used to be the case. Things have gotten better, but you know, the folks I talk to are still concerned that there are many ways that new forest pests could enter the country.
Solving deforestation or preventing plagues in trees feels like a really big burden, something that somebody who has a lot of power has to handle. Are there things that we can do as individuals to stop this from happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I've sort of been discussing, a lot of the forest plagues that we've seen have come in on plants from overseas. And there's always been this idea in landscaping that, you know, our native plants here in North America are not good enough. We need to bring in stuff from elsewhere. And lately, there's been more of a movement toward using native plants. And there's many reasons to use native plants. But in my opinion, one of the big ones is they're not going to bring in a new insect or disease, because they've been here essentially forever. And the insects and diseases that feed on them are well adapted. They're well adapted to kind of coexist together. So choose native plants over imported plants when you're doing your landscaping. And the other thing I would note is that it's become really popular to import kind of exotic plants as house plants. I think this is kind of a big hot new trend right now. And that's not necessarily a very well-regulated industry. You can go online and, you know, click a button and order all kinds of weird plants, as one expert put it to me, and just have them shipped to you. You know, think carefully about where these plants are coming from, if they may pose a risk to plants here, and if you really need them. Or maybe, you know, think about buying instead a native plant from your local garden center. And just one more potential route of introduction is in airplane luggage. People go overseas and see something you like and you want to bring it home. Well, maybe think twice about doing that, because you don't know what else could be hitchhiking on that plant that you love so much.
How concerned are you about the future of our forests?
Well, I worry a lot, because, you know, it looks like our forests are full of trees, and they are, but in a place like Wisconsin, there are not that many different types of trees or genuses, as biologists would put it. the forests are really kind of dominated by a few big genuses like oak, maple, obviously. We mentioned the hemlock and the ash, and there's a handful of others. And each of these pests seems to specialize on a particular genus. So if you lose the hemlock and the ash, and if you could imagine a few more pests coming in that might take out maple and oak, you wouldn't actually have a whole lot left. So I am quite worried about this.
Gabriel, thank you for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that was Gabriel Popkin, who talked with WPR's Keely Baltina. Popkin is a journalist writing about science and the environment. And the recent piece he did in the New York Times, it's called Invasive Insects and Diseases Are Killing Our Forests. We have a link, by the way, at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we get updates on a range of energy projects across our state, transmission lines, solar, wind, nuclear. What is your top priority for utility regulators? Line for you, 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story on gardening.
Across Wisconsin, there are people struggling to access healthy and culturally appropriate foods. It's a complex issue that some communities, like Green Bay, are addressing through community gardens. In 1994, a UW Extension nutritionist started the community garden program there with six families. This summer, more than 250 families are working 12 different plots in a partnership between the city of Green Bay and Brown County. A new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered is digging into those gardens and meeting some of the people who work there. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
Margaret Franchino has been working full time as the Brown County Community Garden Coordinator for the last 8 years.
I love being outside, and I think that was an important part of this. And then the multiculturalism of the gardens was really interesting to me, too, that people of all different backgrounds participate in the program. You know, I meet the most people out in the gardens, you know, just kind of organically being there and crossing paths with people. But it's just so interesting to hear, especially because so many of our gardeners are immigrants and or refugees, just hearing their stories and what gardening means to them and their gardening background. I mean, vast majority of them are much better gardeners than I am, and so a lot to learn from them.
This is what mostly she grows. She grows the collard greens. Mm. This is, what is that, sugar snappy leaves. Lemongrass. Yeah, she plants a lot of lemongrass.
One of the people that will be working in the garden this year is Chow. She's been a community gardener for over 20 years. She's originally from Laos, a place where farming and gardening were a central part of her culture.
Back in Laos, we work in the because of the Hmong population, they all live in the mountain. So mostly you just use your hands and your shovel to work.
Chow started gardening as a kid in those mountains.
Since when I was little, as soon as I know how to dig, that's how I start my garden. And yes, I do remember back in the homeland.
And she still has the tools from back home.
Okay, yes, we do. I do remember that. Because we still have some pictures back there. And also when I arrived to the United States, I actually had some of my own tools or some tools that belonged to my parents. And yes, I still remember a lot of those memories.
Gardener Pedro Perez lived in the area for 17 years. But before that, he was in California and Mexico, two very different growing climates than Wisconsin's. Pedro says his food home, the food that connects him back to those places, is salsa.
I would say tomatoes. Tomato salsa is one of the foods that I really identify with.
La salsa es en casi todas las comidas.
Salsa basically goes in every single food.
So Pedro needs his tomato plants to be hardy. And he's found Wisconsin's shorter growing season does have some benefits. Tomatoes grow better, but the seasons are shorter. So Pedro hustles to maximize the growing time.
I would say around 3 to 4 days per week. Maybe 2 to 3 hours per day.
So you're like a master gardener.
So usted es un maestro en la jardinería.
No, pues es que si no trabaja uno, no cosecha.
If we don't work, obviously we will not be able to harvest our items.
Gardeners here rely on this land. It puts food in their kitchens and pantries throughout the year. But Margaret says the gardens also have another benefit. They build community.
So it really is a place for people to come together and meet people. Gardening is such a universal activity that people of all different backgrounds do. And so it's really special that they can come together and be together in that space. I don't think there's a lot of other spaces like that in the community. And so I think that's a really, really powerful thing.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to tracking energy developments in our state power grid reliability rates set by the Public Service Commission, the PSC, and the status of renewable energy projects. Do you have solar panels on your home or at your workplace? Tell us about your experience. Utilities are shutting down coal-fired power plants. What questions do you have about decommissioning them, like the Edgewater plant in Sheboygan? And what do you want to know about appeals to the Cardinal Hickory Creek Transmission Line Project? 800-642-1234 to join in. Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Well, let's start with this fraught Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line slated to run from Dubuque to Middleton. You know, in recent weeks, the PSC gave notice it intended to rescind the permit for the line. What would that effectively mean?
That is, that's a great question, and sort of what the PSC kind of asked others to weigh in on what it should do. Essentially, the developers have asked for what's basically a redo because the permit has been challenged in court. There was some information that came to light last week when they discovered some new secret communications between one of the commissioners and executives of some of the utilities that threatened to sort of taint the approval. So they basically asked two of the remaining commissioners to rescind the permit and revote on it, essentially taking that tainted commissioner's vote away, which would then sort of render the court challenges moot. Opponents of the line obviously don't want to see that happen. They would love to see the permit rescinded, but they are arguing that it should really be left to the courts right now, or else if the commission is going to reconsider it, they want to see a fresh look where they go back and introduce new evidence and really start over.
What would that mean for the timeline of this high-voltage project, and what about costs?
It would certainly amount to a delay. Right now, the project is scheduled to start construction this fall. They're already out negotiating land, easements, getting together the land they need for it. So the developers say that they need the PSC to act right away, or else they're going to delay the project, which they say could also have ripple effects for a lot of new, mostly solar and other wind farm projects that are counting on that line, that could delay.
Because these alternative energies would be running on that line?
That are counting on that line, at least to some degree.
Okay.
Either they're counting on that line, or they need it to relieve congestion in other places. If they do go back to the PSC, they could be looking at 6 months to a year to completely redo the approval process.
Another twist is the USDA in the mix did an environmental impact study and proposed modifications to the route. What can you tell us there?
That was mostly minor site modifications that came up through talks with landowners where they moved the line, more than a few feet, but relatively small changes to accommodate interferences. But with a more significant change in Iowa, where near the Mississippi River crossing, where they moved it to avoid some Native American burial mounds, all of that, it was moved enough that it was outside of the buffer that had been studied, so that required a sort of supplemental environmental study to look at those. I think it was about 15 acres in total.
There's been just so much litigation raining down over this project, and you know, the Environmental Law and Policy Center, other environmental groups out there. One of the suits going after the Army Corps of Engineers for not doing an independent environmental review. What is at the heart of this legal challenge?
I think it's really just they're going after every possible angle. I think their central cases, they have cases in state and federal court directly challenging the PSC's approval of the permit. And that's where we're hearing all this information about conflict of interest, the allegations of secret communications between one of the commissioners and utility executives. I think then secondarily, they've sort of gone after other agencies who've issued permits that are more tangential, I mean, still essential to the project, but not the primary permit. So, I think they're really trying to cover all their bases.
And when you talk about the conflict of interest here and secret communication, this is tied to former PSC Commissioner Mike Hipsch. Can you explain that a little further?
Yeah. So Commissioner Hipsch was appointee of Governor Walker, who was on the commission during the time that this, this would have been in 2018-2019 that the line was being considered. Initially the groups, it was primarily the Driftless Area Land Conservancy and Wisconsin Wildlife Federation sued, claiming perceived conflicts of interest on the part of Hipsch not because of these secret communications, but because of his involvement with the Midwestern grid operator, mm-hmm. Known as MISO, which was also a party to this line and was pushing for the line. They also alleged conflict of interest by Chair Rebecca Bach because of her previous employment with some of the utilities. In the course of these lawsuits, there was in discovery, they started to find out about texts that Hipsch had exchanged with some of the executives from Dairyland, which is one of the partners in the line. Then it turned out that he had, after leaving the commission, had applied for a job as the CEO of Dairyland. Much of that came out last year. Mm-hmm. Then through further discovery, what was revealed this week is that he had been communicating with executives from some of these utilities using Signal, which is an encrypted messaging app. He testified in court last week that these conversations were purely personal. These are friends he's known for 25 or 30 years, and they were just using it to talk about sports and family and things and not commission business. However, because it is an encrypted app that's set to essentially destroy the messages after a certain amount of time, we don't know exactly who he was talking to or what he was talking to them about. And so that's where it creates, at the very least, an appearance of bias.
Yeah.
that this appears that, you know, what's known as ex parte communications, where when our commissioners are not supposed to be talking outside of the official record.
Yes. So more to follow there as we check in on developments in the energy sector with Chris Hubbock of the Wisconsin State Journal. How are your electricity bills this summer? Have you used more energy in the pandemic as more family members work from home? Do you participate in a shared solar program with your public utility? What are the pros and cons? Join in on Energy 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. Back in a minute with Chris Hubbock here in the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're checking in on energy developments across our state. There's a report in recent days by the Wall Street Journal about how utility companies are paying for coal plant closures by issuing bonds. And it highlighted Milwaukee-based WEC Energy Group using securitization to help finance the shutdown of plants. Is this financing approach the best way to get rid of these old heavy polluters? What do you want to know about the status of the Kewaunee Power Station and the process of decommissioning a nuclear plant? Still time, 800-642-1234. Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, before we move on, we heard from Mark and Kimberly, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Mark wants to know, why are the environmental groups suing, and what damage are they claiming a high-voltage transmission line will do?
I think they see it in the biggest terms as just a sort of a blight on the Driftless area, because this would run through that sort of special region of Southwest Wisconsin. Particularly, there's concerns about just the swath it would cut, the vegetation it takes out, impacts on birds and so forth. I think their biggest concern, more so than those particular problems, is that the line is not needed. They fear that it might, while it's been pitched as a means to support new renewable power, that they fear could be used to prop up some distant coal plants that, you know, because really the line is agnostic in terms of the electricity that runs on it, so that it could in effect prolong the life of some coal plants.
Well, let's move on to renewables. You've been writing about solar farms being built or proposed across the state this year: Sheboygan, Grant County, Fitchburg, northwestern Wisconsin. How is the solar industry doing in our state?
Booming, I think.
All right.
It's hard to keep track of all the proposals of the, you know, what we call utility scale proposals. There's about 3,000 megawatts in the that have either been mostly approved or have applied. I think some of them are under construction. We've only had one that's sort of come online of the really big ones, of the 200 megawatt size. Alliant has plans to spend about $1.5 billion on solar. WEC Energy Group, about $2 billion on solar and wind and other renewables. Utilities are they are investing as fast as they can in new wind and solar, mostly in mm-hmm. solar.
What about on the residential side and it becoming more doable for a household?
One thing that obviously the cost of solar has plummeted over the last 10 years, which makes it a lot more feasible for a lot more people. There's still a lot of upfront cost. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, for a residential system, you might be looking at $10,000 to $20,000. What has made it really appealing for a lot of people is the super low interest rates. There are what's known as green mortgages, where you can fold in energy upgrades, and that could be anything from better insulation to rooftop solar panels, can be sort of folded into a traditional mortgage, and you just pay for it with your housing payments. But also the super low interest rates means a lot of people And I think one study last spring estimated close to 200,000 Wisconsin homes, homeowners who hadn't refinanced would be able to refinance at a lower interest rate and take money out, essentially, you know, take like a home equity loan to pay for solar panels. And then the utility savings would offset, you know, any additional mortgage payment.
Oh, that's interesting. So there, the state of our economy right now and those low interest rates and those opportunities, they're really culminating at a point that boosts solar even on the residential side.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, what is happening on the wind front? It seems you haven't been writing as much about these projects. Is there less activity in building new wind turbines?
Yeah, definitely not to the degree that we've seen with solar. We, in the last year or two, have heard rumblings of some new wind farms, but we've also seen the Sugar River Wind Farm down in Greene County, which got approval from the PSC. Then the developer walked away from the project for reasons that are not entirely clear, but apparently they decided it wasn't going to be profitable. We haven't seen much. That there was another highly controversial wind farm up in northwestern Wisconsin that, you know, despite surviving some court challenges, the developers have yet to start building it. Again, for reasons not quite known.
Yeah.
There have been rumblings of a very large wind farm, a 600 megawatt wind farm that would cover thousands of acres in southwestern Wisconsin. They have not applied for a permit yet. They're still, trying to negotiate land contracts to get all the land they need for it. It has stirred up a lot of opposition. There's a website of a group that's organized to fight it, who just see it as way too big and way too intrusive for that part of the state.
Well, Chris Hubbuck, I just want to make sure that we squeeze in the utility rates and any increases that you see coming out of the PSC.
Sure. They approved Alliance, got a rate hike that will boost electricity rates next year, but then keep them flat the following year. MG&E has requested about a 6% increase for electricity rates next year. That's still pending before the PSC. And WEC Energy Group has proposed to keep their rates for that would be for We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service, to keep those rates flat next year. But then they'll probably be looking for some sort of increase in the following year.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Chris Hubbuck covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. You can find links to some of his recent reporting at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we meet the new host of Simply Folk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Sheila Shigley joins us for an hour-long conversation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.